Sci-Fi Show Outcast. Welcome to Sci-Fi Show Outcast 63. Thanks for tuning in again, everybody. Today I have an interview with Eliezer Yudkowsky from the Singularity Institute. Sorry this interview's out a bit late. Life and the launch of Sci-Fi got in the way, but here it is, and regular programming will resume next week. Thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Eliezer Yudkowsky.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so first up, you're involved with the Singularity Institute. Can you tell me a bit about what you do for them and who they are?
I'm a research fellow of the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. I co-founded the institute. Our purpose is to do fundamental AI work aimed at real AI and at getting humanity through the challenges posed by real AI, hopefully without it getting too messy, you might say. So in terms of what my actual research topic is, I try to develop a reflective decision theory, a theory of thinking about thinking. In the same way that artificial intelligence is probably the most important open problem in science, the most important problem within artificial intelligence is probably thinking about thought. Humans get a tremendous mileage out of thinking about thought, but current AI technology doesn't get any sort of useful mileage out of that. There's no commercial systems that think about themselves. So there's clearly something very important that humans are doing that hasn't quite been figured out yet. As for why all this is important, well, for example, thinking about thought is what you would use to describe an AI that was improving itself, making itself smarter. And that's where most of the opportunity and most of the risk comes in. It's a rather a long story, but I'm sure you have other questions that will get into that.
Indeed. So there seems to be many interpretations of what a technological singularity is. How would you define it?
I'd say that there's actually three major different schools of thought that are now running around all attached to the same term. The original meaning of the word was from a mathematician and science fiction author, Professor Werner Vinge, and his version was at some point you're going to technologically create a smarter-than-human intelligence by enhancing the brain or interfacing the brain to computers, or by creating a pure artificial intelligence. What all of these have in common is that they have the potential to create entities smarter than the smartest humans currently running around. And this is an interesting moment in history, to put it mildly. What Vinge observed was that at the moment when you try to extrapolate your model of the future past that point where the model predicts the existence of entities smarter than you are, the model breaks down. You can't predict past that point. And in the same sense, back when Vinge was making this observation in the 1970s, the laws of physics that physicists currently had, or I should say their model of the laws of physics, broke down when they tried to model the inside of a black hole. So that was the original meaning of the term singularity. It's a place where your model breaks down. Now, just because your model breaks down doesn't mean that reality breaks down. Something happens in the center of a black hole. And if you're ignorant about a phenomenon, that is a fact about your state of mind, not a fact about the phenomenon itself. So something would happen in reality. It was a knowledge problem. The second school of thought is the intelligence explosion, which was invented, depending on who you ask, by either the science fiction editor John W. Campbell or by the Bayesian statistician I.J. Goode. And that's the idea that if you have technology that improves intelligence, well, what's the source of technology? It's intelligence, space shuttles, cars, machine guns, nuclear power plants, medicine. All of this comes from intelligence. There's a master trick, the brain trick, that does all these other tricks of special cases. So if you can use the master trick, the intelligence trick, to create technology that improves intelligence, you've closed the loop. You've created a positive feedback cycle. The purest case of this would be an AI that can rewrite its own source code, make itself smarter, and then, having become smarter, make itself even smarter, and then go back again and redesign itself a third time and make itself even smarter and design itself new hardware and move on to that and become even smarter. So that's the intelligence explosion. And the third school of thought attached to the singularity is Ray Kurzweil's Accelerating Change, which roughly says that our intuitions about historical change are linear. We expect around as much change in the future as there's been in the past. But technological change accelerates. When you try to graph it on a chart, it usually ends up coming out something like exponential. And if so, then there's some point where the curve goes from seeming kind of slow, there's not much progress, to seeming very fast. Holy smokes, where did the internet come from? Where did the computers come from? Well, if you graph it all on a chart, it looks pretty much like a smooth exponential curve. But because our intuitions are linear, it looks to us like this huge technological change came up and blew up out of nowhere.
Okay. When did you first become aware of the possibility of this technological singularity?
That would be at age 16. I happened to pick a book by Werner Vinge off a library shelf. It was called True Names and Other Dangers. And that was when I became acquainted with Vinge's version of the singularity. And I just figured that since this was blatantly, obviously, by far the most important thing going on in the world, well, that's what I was going to spend the rest of my life on.
Fair enough. So what sort of dangers are there from the coming technological singularity, at least potentially?
Well, there's very few people out there who would destroy the world on purpose. You know, no matter who your favorite villain is, whether it's terrorists or the government, they need a world in which to achieve their terrorist goals or government goals. So very few people would destroy the world on purpose. Destroying the world by accident, well, to destroy the world by accident, you'd have to be messing with something pretty powerful. Something like intelligence, which is the most powerful force in the known universe. It's not malice that worries me so much as people screwing up. You build an artificial intelligence, and it improves itself. But, you know, you were driving so hard to solve the super important scientific problem and get all the credit for it that you didn't really think exactly about what was going to happen when it started improving itself. And so it improves itself, but in an unstable sort of way, and it comes out as something that's nothing like what you had in mind, and it's super powerful, and the curtain is rung down on the human species and everything we might have become. And, of course, the flip side of that is the opportunity, which is that intelligence is the most powerful force in the universe. So if you harness it, you can get the benefits of intelligence. And people tend to think of intelligence as book smarts, you know, like, well, here's the college professor, and he's, you know, so smart, but here's the CEO of the company, and he's not as smart, but he has more money. And what they don't realize is that neither a college professor nor a CEO is likely to be a mouse, because mice are not as intelligent as humans. All our technology comes from our intelligence. All of our medicine, all of our computers, everything we've done right and quite a few of the things we've done wrong have all been enabled by our intelligence. So if you can harness intelligence, then if there's been any problem that stumped humanity, like, oh, how are we going to stop the greenhouse effect now that we've pumped all this carbon into the atmosphere? So you reach into mind space and you pull out a bigger hammer, a stronger intelligence, and it solves the problem. It says, okay, I'm going to build some nanotechnology and I'm just going to flush the carbon out of the air. Something like that.
Okay. So what is friendly AI then?
Friendly AI is a concept that I'm credited with inventing, although credit should probably go to Nick Bostrom because he was talking about it a couple of years before I was. And friendly AI, the basic notion is there's an enormously wide space of possibilities for what AI might be like. If you look at a movie, they show you, you know, all AIs are the same type, they're the same tribe. In the case of Agent Smith, they're all the same person. The point being that in actuality, human beings, in all their diversity, we've all got the same brain architecture. We've all got the same prefrontal cortex and cerebellum and hypothalamus. And, you know, we've all got the same basic brain design. So any two AIs could be more dissimilar from one another, you know, by several orders of magnitude compared to the two most different human beings on the face of the earth. So people say, well, are AIs going to kill us or save us? And the answer is, it depends on the exact initial design. Different points in this vast mind design space are going to give you different results. So friendly AI is you reach into mind design space and you pull out an AI that you don't regret having built. Even as it improves itself and modifies itself, it stays stable.
Okay, so how would you ensure that?
The basic concept here is something like Gandhi doesn't want to kill people. If you offer Gandhi a pill that makes him want to kill people, Gandhi will refuse to take that pill because he knows that if he modifies himself in this fashion, he'll want to kill people, and then he will kill people and people will die. And the current Gandhi doesn't want people to die, so Gandhi will refuse the pill. If you don't want to kill people, then you don't want to kill people. So that's the basic principle that will probably be end up being used to guarantee the stability of a friendly AI. But I cannot give a formal proof of this because the current mathematics that are used in the foundations of artificial intelligence go into an infinite loop and catch fire and explode when you try to make them describe a self-modifying AI that is modifying the part of itself that does the modifying. And this is, gets back to the thinking about thought problem I was talking about before. My job is to build a self-improving friendly AI, and to do that, among other problems, one has to come up with a theory of thinking about thought that does not crash, catch fire, and explode when you try to use it to describe a self-modifying AI.
Okay, so we see examples of unfriendly AI portrayed in lots of movies. You made reference to The Matrix, among others. Do you think these sort of scenarios are realistic?
Oh, heck no. The main reason they're not realistic is that if you have an AI that's improving itself, making itself smarter, well, look at it this way. Relative to, say, chimpanzees, humans have around 3 times too much brain and 6 times as much frontal cortex as we should have for an ape our size. So a 3 or 6-fold improvement in hardware got from chimps to humans. And that's what Moore's Law delivers every 5 years or so. And humans can't rewrite their own software. All the change that we saw over the last 100,000 years was done by humans at an essentially constant level of intelligence, just making use of the intelligence they have without being able to reach into their own brains and rewrite the neurons and add new hardware to themselves and all that cool stuff. So the movies are, a movie has to show about a roughly balanced set of forces. Like there's a famous spoof movie called Godzilla versus Bambi, and it shows Bambi sitting around in the forest, and the giant foot comes down and goes squish. That's Godzilla versus Bambi. That's not a movie. If you think about the level of human intelligence, it's very unlikely that you're going to exactly hit that level of intelligence when you build an AI. Either it's going to be a lot dumber than human, like the current AIs, and the AI will go squish, or it's going to be a lot smarter than humans, and the humans go squish. So if you get into a conflict at all with something that's vastly smarter than you are, there's not going to be this whole movie-long battle where you get to, you know, shoot down robots using machine guns. It's just going to build nanotechnology and recycle you for your atoms.
Okay, that's an unpleasant prospect. All right, then.
Well, if the prospect bothers you, try to do something about it. Well, the Singularity Institute was founded. I mean, although I do emphasize that we're not negativists, and we're not we're neither optimists nor pessimists. We're variancists. We see it being able to go either very, very well or very, very poorly, depending on exactly how we do it. And that's why the Institute exists. If it was destined to go very well or if it was destined to go very poorly, there wouldn't be any point.
Okay. And if AIs do become dangerous, or at least have the potential to become so in the future, do you think it will be necessary to have something like the Turing Police, as we see in William Gibson's Neuromancer? And if so, how on earth would that work?
That's an interesting sort of question. I think that the main defense that you want to mount against a bad AI is a good AI. Failing that, don't build the AI to begin with. If you know, once you've actually built something that's hostile and smarter than you, you've kind of already lost the battle. If you're going to win the battle, do it before God is your opponent.
Fair enough.
So the problem that I see with the Turing Police is that it's not going to be perfect enforcement. The way out of the problem is to build a good AI so that you're not left with human intelligence on the side of the angels and superhuman intelligence on the other side. So the problem that I see with the Turing Police is that it is going to leak. It's not a permanent solution.
Okay. Could you please explain the giant cheesecake fallacy? What is it and how does it work?
Well, the giant cheesecake fallacy goes something like this. Now, the first lemma is that the smarter you are, the bigger the cheesecake you can make. Would you agree with that?
That seems reasonable.
So if you are super intelligent, you can make really large cheesecakes, cheesecakes the size of whole cities, right?
Okay.
And Moore's law is doubling computing power per dollar every 18 months. Therefore, the future will be full of giant cheesecakes.
All right.
And the moral is that power does not imply motive. You see the giant cheesecake fallacy whenever somebody says, well, if an AI is smarter than us, it could wipe us out. We shouldn't develop AI. Or an AI that's smart enough could cure cancer and give food to the hungry. Therefore, we should develop AI. Or even if we develop AI, then the AI will do all the jobs and humans will have nothing left to do and will starve or sit around all day watching television. In all these cases, you're jumping from capability to motive.
Okay.
Pretty much. I mean, the notion I would want to suggest is not just that it doesn't follow logically, but that it doesn't follow because there's an enormous space of possibilities. And you could pick out an AI that would exterminate humanity. You could pick out an AI that would heal the sick. You could pick out an AI that would make giant cheesecake. It's a big space. There's a lot of possible minds you could build. Of course, just because it's possible to build those minds doesn't mean we have the motive to build those minds.
Okay.
Well, this is probably the largest issue confronting the human species at the moment, and it doesn't seem to get a whole lot of attention. The human species can probably win on this, but it's not going to be easy because we're going to have to build a friendly AI before anyone anywhere builds an unfriendly one, where the problem is not so much malice, but carelessness, or not even realizing that there's a problem. You know, you haven't heard a whole lot about this problem. Well, that's because there's not being a whole lot said about this problem. So what we're looking at here is pretty much like a giant wave around about to crash down on the human species. And the question right now isn't even are we going to win so much as are we going to be able to field a non-pathetic force on the battlefield? Is anyone going to pay attention to it at all? So if you would rather not see the solar system turned into a giant cheesecake or whatever else happens if you build an AI without quite knowing what you're doing, I would suggest paying a bit more attention to this issue. In fact, let me rephrase that. Pay attention, people!
Okay. So, if people want to learn more and prepare for our coming robot overlords, where's a good place to look?
The Singularity Institute website at singinst.org, or type Singularity Institute into Google. I'd also recommend to some extent my personal website at yudkowsky.net or Google on Yudkowsky.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today, Eliezer Yudkowsky. I hope everyone else found that interview as interesting as I did. So, you'll find links to Eliezer's website and the Singularity Institute in the show notes for this episode, as well as a link to the movie Bambi vs. Godzilla. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. Talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.